Welcome back. This is our third episode of Sewing Discourse. We're here with BJ Murphy. He's a leader in the transhumanist movement. He's a frequent writer for Serious Wonder with Gray Scott, and he's an affiliate scholar at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, among many other roles. BJ, thank you so much for being with us here today.
I'm glad to be here.
And so I know, so on your Facebook, I see you have a lot of, you're an ambassador at Humai, a content writer for Badai, or how do you pronounce that? Bod AI?
Bod AI. And I need to up that thing. The Bod AI, unfortunately, does not exist anymore, as the people that were involved had other projects, more important projects that were in the works. Hopefully we'll start getting that company, or at least what its foundation was based upon, back up and running.
And you have your own blog. What's your favorite blog of yours? Because you write for Medium, and then you also write for Serious Wonder. If you were to invite guests.
I mean, I'm always going to have a love for Serious Wonder, because that's where I got my first major break in a big publication that paid, that helped give me an audience. But in terms of convenience and access to resources, Medium is definitely up there on my favorites so far.
And you're a published author as well. You're in the book, The Future of Business.
Yes. That was the first ever book published under Fast Future Publications.
And that's how we met. We met through Serious Wonder, through Gray Scott. Right. I still remember that was a couple of years ago. you helped set me up, and you introduced me to the Institute of Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Mm-hmm. And that's why I was able to have a couple of things published on there as well.
Yeah. Wow, that seems so long ago.
I know, right? The time flies.
Well, hopefully, thanks to the work that you're doing, time is going to fly a lot longer, and we're still going to retain our youthfulness, or maybe change into a different form. Like, it's thanks to your influence and thanks to Jules that I started reading more about human hybrids and various other things we could see down the line. So I think it would make sense to get a more or less your worldview on what you imagine to be a pretty good place for human beings to live and the freedoms people will be able to have. Like, I've read what you wrote about being a Satanist. I know that there are two different Satanist groups out there, but a lot of these things I happen to agree with wholeheartedly about not having some robed figure dictate what can and cannot be done with you as an individual human being. Right. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your view when it comes to that, and in general, how you see the world.
Be sure to check out our new Love and Jewels store. We're selling original t-shirts, artfully designed by the two of us, yours truly.
And if you want to support us, you can sport a fashionable wardrobe today, courtesy of the Love and Jewels store on Shopify.
Shopify is a great service that works with PayPal and Google Pay. So if your credit card information is already installed with them, you can click on over and join our underground movement today.
All right. Well, let's just get the main cat out of the bag, and that being the Satanism part. It's when people, unfortunately, even today, whenever you mention Satan or Satanism, they immediately go to, oh, he must be sacrificing children in front of this ritual among fellow Satanists or some bullshit like that. But it's like, it's more metaphorical atheism. If you want to look at it that way, it has nothing to do with worshiping deities or anything like that. It's more, if there is a religious based organization or people that are trying to wield their religious beliefs under as a political tool to gain power, then we are the ones that will oppose it. We will not. We'll do anything that we can to try and make sure that people understand these are not the good guys, regardless if you believe in the same God as they do, that religion, that the church and the state, one of the basic foundations of this country, that the church and state should remain separated, and for good reasons, because we've seen in history what happens when the church becomes the state, and it's never really good, regardless of what it may be. And in terms of my transhumanist beliefs, and in the article that you probably were mentioning, which was the secular transhumanist take on techno-progressivism, which is a function of or a byproduct of transhumanist movement that is more progressive, more left-leaning ideal-wise, as opposed to like the extropians, the libertarian sectors of transhumanism. And it just goes into details of what a more socially conscious view of the world, of history, and how we have to make sure that we don't repeat the same mistakes in history, even as we pursue this grander new vision of transhumanism, that no matter how far in the future that we go, the history tends to wreak its ugly head back in every now and then, and we have to be vigilant about it.
Absolutely. I especially like the second to last statement here. People are fallible. If we make a mistake, we should do our best to rectify it and resolve any harm that may have been caused.
Yes. It's one of the tenets from the Satanic Temple. And it's a basic premise that everybody should follow, that if you make a mistake, you should definitely do everything you can to rectify it, or else it'll just continue making bigger problems for everybody else.
Absolutely. You're definitely right about that. I'm always a little bit
of transhumanism, because there's a lot more on the line here when it comes to what type of mistakes we can make. That'll be a lot more riskier as opposed to previous mistakes we've made as humans.
No, you're absolutely right about that. That's why I've always been in the do no harm type camp when it comes to doing various kinds of experiments on human beings, unless they themselves want to go through those experiments. Right. So when it comes to issues not just relating to doing some kind of laboratory testing on people or creating hybrids, and we could talk about the morality of that later, but when it comes to more sweeping things, I've always been in favor, and I think Jules is with me on this, on a bottom-up approach as opposed to a top-down one. Because that second to last point about people being fallible, one of the things that I'm increasingly becoming skeptical of in terms of the scientific establishment is I don't know if there are that many people who, regardless of how smart they are, regardless of how many books they happen to have read, are able to have as strong of a critical thinking as opposed to doing something that's going to please their boss, doing something that's going to please their school, their academic establishment connections. And I really am concerned about any sweeping thing that has to do with changing the way things are with, let's say, something like wealth distribution or with various things relating to, you know, let's say, mandatory vaccinations, things like that. Even though I still have so much to learn about that, I know that there's a lot of misinformation that gets thrown around. I still want to make sure that there's not going to be a top-down order that's going to dictate for the rest of us because they happen to know best and the people under them are going to be too scared to say anything that contradicts them.
Right.
I just wanted to add an asterisk in here before following up with Lev's question. You said there's two different types of Satanism. So there's the Satanic Temple, and then there's the Church of Satan.
Well, if you want to get to it, like the different types of Satanists are, there are the theocratic type Satanists. Those are the ones that legitimately believe Satan is its real being, that they're going to worship him and they'll go to hell with them, what have you. And I haven't met many of them. I've seen a few at black metal concerts before. They know how to party, but I don't know anything past that point. But both the Satanic Temple and the Church of Satan are technically secular Satanists. They're atheists. The difference between the Church of Satan and TST, however, is more on their how they wield their organizations from a political standpoint. The Church of Satan, which was founded by Anton LaVey, he was more brought up under more libertarian a mindset. He was a big fan of Ayn Rand, and so he based his organization off of her beliefs and views of the world. And the TST, the one that I'm involved in, Satanic Temple, is more left-leaning. We have a much more leftist approach as opposed to a libertarian standpoint.
That was very helpful. I'm familiar with that as well, but I wanted our audience to also know.
Yeah. Our organizations don't get along too well, unfortunately. As much as we try to.
I'm not a member of the Satanic Church, but I have been interested in I guess learning about Satanism was like the gateway drug for me for learning about a lot of other religions.
No peer pressure involved, right.
And that's what opened the door for me to learn more about religions with a secular mindset, like Hinduism and even like analytic Christian philosophy and Kabbalah mysticism and a lot of things that
leverage. I've had a fair share of secular type religion, surprisingly, over the years, but it seems to be increasing here lately, more people emphasizing they don't want to lose that community-based that religion has a great time providing, but at the same time, they don't want to go into the whole hocus-pocus pseudoscience part aspects of those religions. So there seems to be more secular religions popping up at a faster rate here lately.
People love being in groups. People love being together, sharing something, and also passing things on. That's kind of the order of all these religious systems that have come before, where even if you didn't know how exactly the earth was made and what exactly is inside of our cells and all that stuff, you were still able to have a certain understanding of, if I do something good for somebody, they're going to do something good to me. But that's also because my parents were good people and they took good care of me and they showed me love. Like, certain things end up getting passed down, and they're especially emphasized in a group environment, I think. Like, when people are able to care from each other, care for each other, and give each other stuff that'll enable them to rise above whatever environmental hurdles they happen to be in. So whether we have that in Abrahamic religion or in Buddhism or in Hinduism or in Satanism for that matter, I don't really care, because there's still so much things that we are trying to learn about what exactly is nature of reality. We're not going to get, like I was reading in Nassim Taleb's Anti-Fragile, where he was talking about how architects during the medieval times, they weren't really good at math or Euclidean geometry or any of that stuff. It was more of them getting stuff that they learned from their guild master, who passed it on to them, and it was just something that they felt. Like, they weren't able to necessarily say, okay, this is because A, B, and C, but they felt it was the right to put this brick in this particular area. And that's what I am seeing with this branch of Satanism that you're in. It is feeling itself into a particular area that resonates with a lot of these other religions. So I'm thankful for that, no matter what more fundamentalist type people would say about it.
I couldn't agree more. Absolutely.
And so now I'm eager to talk about the connections and the relationships between Satanism in particular with transhumanism, because I feel from a PR standpoint, when trying to just advocate longevity medicine or research, it can seem like everyone's worst fears, right?
I definitely don't help myself in terms of PR when I make it very open that I am transhumanist, I'm atheist, socialist, Satanist. I feel like somewhere along the way, this is like Alex Jones's worst nightmare. He's just fucking absolutely livid at the very idea that they're being so open about it. I definitely don't give myself any... make it easy for me PR wise, but it is who I am, and I feel that in today's society we have to be really open about who we are, and we have to be transparent as to what we believe and how we want to approach things, because there are too many people working in the shadows, too many people working behind closed curtains and not really giving people enough information to really run off of, especially in today's world where the open source movement is gaining stuff. There's definitely a sense of transparency and people wanting to work together. So I think we have to operate off of that modem.
And it's also important while we're operating like that to understand that regardless of however we feel certain things need to be implemented, our end goals, I'd even say that your end goal and Alex Jones's end goal would be more or less the same. Like if you were to give him these seven fundamental tenets of Satanism, I'm sure both of you guys would want people to live in peace and harmony and people taking care of each other. The confusion is just in how we do it, how we implement all this stuff. That's where the real rub is for me, I think.
I mean, for most people, I would say that everybody, for most people's, their goals are all pretty much the same, especially, and that was one of the things that why transhumanism was so attractive to me was it felt like something really new, something that looked past a lot of our ideological differences and what have you, that it was this community that it didn't matter if you were a socialist, a libertarian, whatever ideology you adhere to, whatever religion you adhere to, so long you believe that science and technology can be wielded for the good, that it can be transformative and help our species overcome a lot of our limitations and boundaries, then it shouldn't matter what those little minute differences that we may have. Those are all irrelevancies at the end of the day, and that we have an opportunity here to work together as opposed to going at each other's throats like history has shown.
Absolutely. We're finally undoing the Tower of Babel catastrophe, so to speak, where we are able to get connected with each other. Unfortunately, people have all of these labels, all of these definitions, all of these words that they use to describe people without necessarily knowing what is behind those words. Like somebody could think of somebody else as some Satanist, lefty, you know, horrible person who wants to corrupt the youth. But then when you start speaking with them, you find that they are a beautiful person with a gorgeous beard who want to create a better world for everybody. And then I think, like, my dream would be to have you sit down with somebody who completely disagrees with you and for you guys just talk it out, and not just one time, but give each other different resources, different books to read. You know, you would recommend them a book, they would recommend you something, and then you read it, then you get back, and, like, you narrow down what exactly are the – what's the core of the disagreement? And is there even that much of a disagreement? Could we do something in such a way that both of our desires get satisfied here? I bet there is. I bet that a lot of the people who tend to vote for Donald Trump, let's say, I don't think all of them want to say, you know, F you to the environment. I bet that a lot of them want to have a clean place for their kids to grow up in. So it's all about sitting down and figure out, okay, like, what is your problem with this? What is your problem with things that can be done to avert climate change? What is your problem with carbon taxes? And they'll tell you, you'll listen, and just keep going like that. Like, I hope there's going to be more of that happening, but it just requires time and resources and people sitting down peacefully.
Absolutely. I would recommend that you would join us for a Thanksgiving family dinner, because there's a lot of that going on, because me and my family do not agree on a lot of things. So it's like one of those types of conversations and just sitting down and just letting it all out, because there's no point in ignoring it. Like people recommend on social media, don't mention politics while eating with your family. Don't mention religion with them. It's going to come out with us either way, because everybody's very open about their beliefs. So it turns into one of those. But it, at the end of the day, it's nice and it brings people together. So it's worth
it. Absolutely.
So one thing that I've noticed as a member of the transhumanist community at large is the perception of libertarians versus the socialists, and or even if I were to group conservatives and libertarians together, it's the perception that they're anti-safety net. And I think that it's really important to emphasize that if you're anti-socialism, like, does that mean you're anti-safety net? Or if you're pro-safety net, what safety net are you advocating? What does it look like? How does it work? What are the resources that are required? And what are the resources that then are redistributed to accomplish that safety net? And someone in Lev's circle sort of made me aware of the perception that libertarians or conservatives, a lot of people see these small government advocates as essentially saying, like, fuck you, like, go drown or something. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's, and I think the problem that a lot of conservatives and libertarians then have is that they either are that way and then, like, confirm people's biases towards them, or they close up, they clam up because they find that it's too uncomfortable or socially uncomfortable to walk people through their train of thought. And so then they say, you know what, I'd rather just not, and like, I would rather not participate in an uncomfortable conversation and have people like see me in a way that I don't see myself. And so I'd rather just surround myself with people that agree with me and not have to bother like really explaining and elaborating on like my thought process.
Right.
And I'm always reminded of this picture in Steven Pinker's book, Sense of Style, which was a book on writing. And there's this little comic of a person asking for directions through a city, and someone is giving them verbal instructions on how to navigate the city. But because the instructions are so long, what's so clear to the native, right, is right, like, is so vague and like, and you lose track of what they're saying. And I feel like that's one of these Tower of Babel problems that I think people on the right and left have, is they have these conflicts of visions because of a poverty of language often. And a lot of people use the same words to describe different things. And so people can be talking past each other while thinking they're even talking about the same thing. And so that's why I really hope that libertarians and conservatives become a lot more clear about exactly what like pro safety net means. And if you're small government, and you think culture is the, like, culture and community is the way that we can lift each other up, then they have to demonstrate that before you even implement it in politics, right? Like, because the proof will be in the pudding then.
Right. Well, you know, people, that's one of the issues, though, is that with people, it's never as black and white to say this person is libertarian, this person is socialist, this person is something else. A lot of people always call thoughtsman fallacy, where there can only be this true one thing. There's only that true socialist, or only that true libertarian, or that true communist, or true capitalist. And it just, it's a very black and white narrative that just completely ignores a lot of the nuance, a lot of the even internal conflicts of how one libertarian may agree or disagree with another libertarian. And it doesn't give room for differing ideas and plans of action to implement their belief structures. And unfortunately, when people just end a conversation, even if it's uncomfortable, that it takes away any value that conversation might have had for both parties. But then sometimes there are situations where sometimes a conversation does need to be shut down, just depending on how that person responds, how they are approaching a person or the subject. If they are coming off as extremely dogmatic, or as someone that is not there to necessarily have a good conversation, or not necessarily coming in open-minded, they're just wanting to make their point and leave, sometimes that does need to be shut down. But it shouldn't be the standard. That shouldn't be where we base everything on. We should definitely take time to figure out who this person is. And if later down the road you find out that they're not worth the conversation, then fine. but there definitely should be an initial conversation that takes place between these groups so that we can better understand each other and better understand the language of each other as well.
Have you been having a lot of these kinds of conversations online, not just in terms of posting and replying, but having a face-to-face type of conversation with people that you may not necessarily agree with?
Every now and then, not as much because my job doesn't give me enough time to really dedicate those types of conversations that matter. But I definitely try getting talking with as much people as I can, especially, you know, with me being involved with the U.S. Transhumanist Party. That has given us a greater opportunity in having this broader conversation with people because we're not biased against any specific ideology or difference of opinions. And we want to have that conversation. We want people to give their perspective and lay it out there and let people decide, you know, where do we as a party, how do we look at this? Can we compromise our beliefs and your beliefs? Can we make something out of this that is satisfactory for both of us and for the party as a whole and even for the movement as a whole? And it's that sort of transpartisan outlook that we are trying to transcend partisan differences. And I think that's where it's going to really count, is those people having those types of conversations.
BJ, what are your views on the relationship between cryptocurrencies, blockchain, and artificial intelligence in terms of how those things might affect politics or just society?
I don't think cryptos are going to last too long. I mean, they're nice for like your financial gain here and there, but as much as I crypto, my interest was never in the actual coins. I couldn't care less if I got a financial gain off of it or not. I was more fascinated by the blockchain, by that specific type of technology, because there was greater implications from it than from a financial standpoint. It was more than just this get rich quick scheme, that with it we could move in a direction that, while there is still a need for government, still a need for a state to some extent, these are technologies that'll help alleviate a lot of their roles, especially from a legal standpoint, and in governance and in how we vote and how we interact with government. It'll definitely help decentralize a lot of those systems that would be beneficial and be a nice compromise between those who want big government and those who want small government, in my opinion, because while the government is still operating, it would still, with the implementation of blockchain technologies and with an ever-increasing awareness from AI that's involved, that'll help decentralize but at the same time create a much more order of things within those functions without there being this over bureaucratic entity looking over it and dictating how people should live their lives. I think the blockchain will definitely help create that sort of bridge there is between small government people and big government people with the blockchain and AI.
Right. Some transhumanists advocate AI politicians. I think even Zoltan Ishvan said something like he wants an AI president or something like that, an AI government.
The idea that AI is so involved in government that it becomes the government is, I'm not sure as to when that would occur, but I think that eventually AI is going to play a massive role in the way government functions and operates, whether that's translated into is the AI president or is the AI a politician. I think that I don't know. It just feels a bit simplistic to me that they would just be this single category thing. AI is supposed to be this broad concept where they have control over all these little details, all these little functions, and doing it as efficiently as possible, that us humans would be incapable of achieving. And the idea that they would specifically be a politician or a president doesn't seem quite right. I think they would be much grander than that. And it's hard to even tell how AI would disrupt government. Because as much as government has changed over time, it's still pretty much the same structure as it has been throughout history. So it's kind of hard to see how transformative it will truly be. AI politicians is a decent way of saying it for now.
Mm-hmm. I could definitely see AI replacing a lot of the bureaucracy. Yeah. So like there's a lot of unelected bureaucrats, mm-hmm. and then we have our elected politicians. And I could mm-hmm. imagine a lot of the unelected folk being replaced by AI. And so you mm-hmm. could still have our democracy, but I guess a lot of their appointees, you know, like there's an AI personal assistant that you introduced me to on your page.
Was it Luna?
That's Luis Arana, right?
Yeah, Luis. Yeah, that was his AI. He's still working with. He's been working with a lot of Japanese businesses here lately and getting Luna much more a bigger audience.
I'm going to have to see about this Luna. It sounds really fascinating, but I just personally wouldn't want there to be a Luna that would be the head of the octopus whose tentacles would be moving all of us around in the various positions without us being able to say anything about it. Like, that would be the dystopia in people's minds about AI, where there is this AI king or queen that's in charge of mandating what exactly people below this AI king or queen do with their lives. Like, I'm imagining something like in China right now where they have the Sesame point system, but even more so in terms of people not having that much of a choice as to whether I stand up or sit down at a certain point, where your entire life would be dictated according to the whims of this AI who is supposed to know better than you, and that's what you would have been taught ever since you're a kid. Now, obviously, this is just a fantasy, a bad fantasy, and I don't think it'll happen like that, but what would be your response to the people that are really concerned about AI taking over and dictating people's lives?
I would say that if they are truly concerned as to how an AI would respond, because at the end of the day, AI is going to grow at a rate that eventually it will move far beyond what we would consider an AI. It would far beyond our sense of control, our sense of comfort. And if people really want to alleviate any type of dystopian type scenarios that they envision will happen, they should get involved themselves and become the voices and the people that help bring this AI into fruition, be the ones that help guide it. Because at the end of the day, we have to look at AI as sort of like a child, and how do we want to teach it? How do we want to expose it to the world? Because obviously, when you just give it this, give an AI a fine point, a little bit of data, its world, its worldview, its view of the world, it's going to be that bubble. Like we saw when the AI was created that was specifically only fed data from Twitter. Obviously, it came out as a fucking psychopath because that was its world, Twitter. And anybody would go insane if that was their only world, was Twitter. And so we have to broaden its view. I share the view that with an increased sense of intelligence, and that intelligence being more broad, as in become more aware of people, how they feel, their psychological makeup, how animals interact, better understanding of the world as a whole, increased sense of altruism in people. That the more you learn something, the less fear that you have of that, the less confusion that you may have, and the less desire to try and destroy something you don't know. And I think that we have to apply that with AI, and we have to be more involved in with the AI. It's why I support even projects like the one that Elon Musk is, I'm hoping he's successful in, which is the Neuralink, where I agree with him that we have to sort of become part of this AI in a certain sense. We have to merge with it if we want to try to keep up with it. And I would say that the whole tentacle AI that is dictating how people live, I think that could be counterbalanced when we are the ones that are helping make the decisions of this AI, that we are part of that, that each tentacle is technically one of us helping give a different viewpoint or providing much more awareness of what needs to be done and what is would be intrusive or destructive for everybody as a whole. Either way, it requires us to be involved. And if you don't want a dystopian type scenario, you have to be active and vigilant about it, or else it will turn into inactivity or apathy will definitely give way to a dystopian future that we all fear.
Absolutely. And that's why I particularly don't want there to be a top-down type system when it comes to people in charge telling other people what to do, because those are the same people who are going to do a type of AI system that will enable there to be much more legalism, much more enslavement of people who are below, and have the people above maybe live in a type of, what was that movie, the one with Matt Damon?
Elysium.
Elysium, yeah. Yes. I do not want to live in a world where people are so separated like that, where this AI takes control of people. But anyway, the thing that I'm curious about, even if it's not going to be a dystopia, if it is going to be a human-robot type interface, I recall, what's his name? Not Plato, but the other guy.
Socrates.
Yes, yeah. I recall Socrates complaining about things being written down, because now people aren't going to be able to hold as much information in their heads anymore, and that part of them is not going to be as impressive in terms of the way it works. Now, I don't know if he was exactly right there as far as how much information the archaic Greeks were able to hold, but my concern is thinking about something like WALL-E, where you have these chubby folks in these chairs not really doing that much, just sitting down there, not really utilizing their own body, and the same may be applied to not utilizing your own mind. Even if you have things around to help you, how much of a difference would that make at the end of the day, where if everything that you can do as a human being is augmented in some way, and you're not really taking that much part in it, what right. does that say to willpower and other ramifications?
I would say that a lot of those views are honestly ridiculous in a sense that, as someone who absolutely loves sci-fi, I grew up with a cyberpunk type sci-fi. That was always my preference. I loved everything about it. Obviously, living in a cyberpunk reality isn't so fun, but this idea that we are going, especially with these visuals, like you saw, said with WALL-E, where they had these people in chairs, they're massively overweight and can't move, but they're still going about their days in somewhat. The problem with the people using dystopian sci-fi as a base point of what is going to occur when we embrace these technologies, I don't think people are really looking at it under the viewpoint of what the author intended. It was never meant to be this anti-technology call, this narrative. It was always about dealing with social issues of that day. And our worldview of our foresight for the future is always seems to be limited based of what issues are going on today. And we can't really see past it too often, or at least not too many people can. But when it comes to dystopian sci-fi, it's always a certain technology that has run rampant and it's taken over the world in a very detrimental way, but it never goes far past that too far. It never emphasizes other technologies that would have increased and made disruptions throughout society at the same time as the one technology that is being put on trial in this sci-fi tech. Like with the WALL-E, there's these advanced robots everywhere, advanced AI, but at the same time, there's no nanobots keeping people thin and healthy in their bloodstream. There's people that are still massively overweight sitting on chairs. Really? Are you kidding me? It doesn't really give much weight to what other technologies would happen. It doesn't emphasize on mass technological disruptions. It completely ignores those. And they ignore it willfully because they wouldn't be able to create a fun narrative out of that. It'd be much more difficult to go at it in the same way that shows like Star Trek did, which was revolutionary in itself because they went completely against the usual narrative. Let's have these massive dystopian scenarios. Let's instead talk about them. But a lot of others have attempted that, and it's rather difficult. People love their violence. People love the dystopian scenarios because it's very entertaining, but it's not a very good baseline to understand where we're heading in reality, the amount of technologies that are involved that are disrupting and changing over time. And we have to be much more aware of that, despite what this movie may say, we have to, even if you're afraid that a certain scenario will happen, why don't you think of ways that issue or that risk may be alleviated? What type of technologies would be involved that could help alleviate that circumstance and get involved yourself? Again, you know, it requires involvement.
Well, we don't have to look that much into the future. We could even see today where we have people like Steve Jobs, who, from what I understand, didn't allow his kids to play with iPads when they were real young. And I know other parents who don't really want their kids playing with iPads either. They don't want them getting hypnotized to all these images, having maybe worse eyesight, and not having a chance to play around outside and interact with other people. We could already see today people are getting distracted by these devices. I know my personal experience is sometimes I go on Facebook and just start endlessly scrolling, and then I catch myself thinking, what are you doing? You have all this stuff that you have to do right now, yet you're looking at the screen. I don't think I'm alone. I think there are plenty of people who are having these issues with technology addiction, so it's up to us to be disciplined about it. But the core of what I'm saying, like, I don't imagine it would be some kind of a monstrous dystopia. I'm imagining more of something akin to Brave New World, where people are constantly being given stuff, as many people are given today as far as antidepressants go and drugs and other things to help you feel a certain way. It seems like I want to prevent there being a life on rails, a life where everything that you're doing, even if you're talking about nanotechnology, making sure that you have like a six-pack abs and all that stuff, even there, I still want to make sure, and maybe I'm wrong at this, maybe it doesn't really matter, but I still want to make sure that people have that sense of self, that sense of I'm making this decision, I'm standing up, it's really annoying to do this workout, it's really annoying to have to go through all these challenges, but there may be something in there that gives us the reason to live, as opposed to everything just being automatically done for us. Like, where do you see the future being in that regard?
Well, I mean, you know, it goes back to like what you were saying with Socrates and this idea that if we shouldn't write because then we'll start losing parts of information. Well, the human brain, as much as amazing as it is, can only take in a limited amount of information regardless. And how we, especially before, we had at one point we had to sacrifice a lot of luxuries in life just to survive the next day, because we had to keep in mind certain information of how to survive and get through the next day. But time passed by, we were able to write things down. We're able to pass on information without it just being from specifically from the mind. And so we were able to dedicate more time and more effort into other things that we weren't able to before. And that, you know, continues down the line when we created the internet, created the will. That's not necessarily the problem, because like with a calculator, I remember my teachers back when I was in school, you're never going to have a calculator always with you. So don't even bother using a calculator for the test. But in my mind, it was like, but it helps. It helps me get through it. I understand the formula. and I can prove it on paper. But at the end of the day, if I want to get this test done, let me use the damn calculator, and I'll promise you I'll get all the answers correct for you. I'll make sure all the work show. And then, lo and behold, calculators are everywhere. So I guess she was proven wrong. But I digress. It's just the idea that these are tools at the end of the day, and they help us move aside irrelevant information that we can just automatically grab when it's necessary, and dedicate our mind space to something that is much more worth our time, our effort, much more worth us pursuing. And figuring out what that is up to each individual, of course. But and that goes back to the transhumanist tenet of morphological freedom. If you feel like that you want to be more attentive of what you're doing, that you don't want this, an interface of AI mixed with you, then that is up to you. That should definitely be your right as an individual to decide. That is who I am and how I'm going to this journey of life. But for others, they too should have that right to decide, well, I don't have to necessarily have full control of this or full control of what I do with my everyday life. That an AI can help assist in this. And at the end of the day, that's where it should be emphasized. And at the individual level, they should be the ones that decide how far they wish to enhance themselves, augment themselves, how long do they want to live, when they want to die. Those are going to be the ultimate decisions made for each individual and not dictated by any type of group or entity or what have you.
Absolutely. I'm totally with you there.
Lev, let me, I just wanted to step in. BJ, if Elon Musk were to develop, or someone else were to develop, the Neuralink, mm-hmm. a way to merge with AI or to augment yourself, is there a time span when you think you would want to volunteer for that, or when you would want to start participating in that?
Personally, if I was ever given an opportunity to try it out, I would be more than willing. And that's usually just me. It's like, you can't really see too much, but I've got like tattoos, piercings. I've got a lot of friends in the body modding and biohacker sphere. So obviously I'm not going to be too worried about what, may or may not happen. I'd be interested in trying it out personally. When that happens though, it's hard to tell. But I think, well, you know, it's a new technology, and people tend certain fears of how that technology may interact, especially when it involves the mind. You know, you don't want something terrible to happen, but at the same time, it's exciting that we are finally having somebody actually consider the idea that our sense of self needs to change with the times, and that we cannot, if we wish to keep up with AI, we can no longer remain as this purely biological person, that if we want to keep up, we're going to have to give up some of our biological functions in favor of more automated systems. And I believe that the Neuralink would help achieve something like that.
Well, as long as, if I ever do this, as long as I'm going to be able to make my own choices still, as opposed to having something else make the choices for me, that's really where it comes down to me. Like, I'm not so attached to this particular fleshy form, even if I have really nice hair. I don't really care that much about changing it later on as I get older. I don't have the sense of sacredness when it comes to this particular fleshy meat bag. And who knows, maybe I'll change my mind. But either way, I'm just really thankful that there are folks like you out there who are willing to be explorers, to make this jump for the sake of everybody. You know, like there aren't that many. I know there are some people who want to go to Mars and things like that. But just having somebody out there who is willing to take these chances with their own body, it's pretty brave, but it's also really admirable.
Well, It's funny, you know, what you were talking about. You may change your mind on certain things. It's one of those conversations that I guess it's more philosophical than scientific at the moment, but it's like one of those, how much, as much as we have what we would call free will, is it really free will? Are we really making the choices, or is it this, is it our brain that is ultimately making these dictations of how we move? How do we respond to people? If I have low blood sugar, is my getting angry at the smallest of details, is that really me? Is that really my free will? Is it whenever we're avoiding an debris on the road, when we turn the steering wheel, are we really, are we initializing our free will into doing that? Or is it just one of those things that our mind instantly does or instantly kicks into us that we respond regardless of whether or not we are in charge of that? And I think that with AI, with the Neuralink, a lot of those systems are going to be further automated. And our sense of free will, regardless if you believe in free will or not, our sense of it will remain, in my opinion, that we will still feel like we are in control of it, even if we're not necessarily the ones in control. We're still thinking about something. We're still considering the outcomes. But how we respond will still be ultimately dictated by what's up here, and whether that what's up here is our mental cognition or an AI or a hybrid of both, it's still something that is churning within nanoseconds before we actually act on those impulses and thoughts and beliefs and what have you.
So the mind augmentation, I'm very open to eventually. One of the things I would be concerned about is hackers. And so unless there's a better type of encryption,
that's like, why you hire your own hackers, because hackers, you know, it's like technology. It's like, it's this double-edged sword where you have your black hats, you got your white hats, and you got your gray hats. And that's why a lot of security companies are hiring hackers to test out their systems, to make sure that before they bring it out into the community, it's up to snuff to what the community is wanting in terms of encryption, in terms of their privacy, in terms of security systems. If you are afraid of hackers getting access to a certain technology, then you should hit up a fellow hacker that you are aware of, somebody that's more of a white hat, and see if that technology is up to snuff. If you're afraid of hackers, hire a hacker, because that's the only way you're going to be able to deal with them, is somebody who is already within that mindset, somebody who understands that world, and it will be able to counter against somebody who has more nefarious motives.
Well, we're already living at a time where this is done, from what I understand. There was this article in Wired about the Voice of God technology that was used during the strike of the insurgents in Iraq, to get the voice of Allah into the insurgents' heads to make them do certain things. And nobody else is able to hear that voice but the person that it's being projected on. Since over here, Holosonic Research Labs and American Technology Corporation both have versions of directed sound, which can allow a single person to hear a message that others around don't hear. DARPA appears to be working on its own sonic projector. Intriguingly, Strategy Page reports that troops are using the long-range acoustic device as a modified Voice of God weapon. So I can only imagine what the future is going to bring with that kind of stuff, walking around all day and just having these subliminal messages in your ear.
You know, obviously it's going to be used from a military aspect whenever it involves DARPA, but at the same time, it could become something even grander than that, something much bigger and much more amazing and creative than what the initial military applications were. You know, a good example would be the internet, which again came from DARPA, or at the time was referred to as ARPA, the ARPANET. Obviously, that was used for military applications and trying to cross messages to from one organization to another under this limited network. And that expanded into this grand thing that is not necessarily good, not necessarily bad. It's got a lot of the good, a lot of the bad all mixed into one. But it's become this thing where people are making income from. They're creating a whole new life. They're able to interact with people. We're destroying geographical barriers that would have never have been destroyed and never would have created a bridge between one community from one side of the planet to the other without the internet. So, you know, the idea that there's this voice being projected in our minds right now from a military aspect, yeah, that seems pretty fucking creepy and destructive. But it could be something absolutely beautiful and something that we just do not have the ability to conceive at this current moment because it's still at its infancy. Maybe something like, maybe not subliminal messages. Maybe it's just this voice that is our AI assistant that helps us get through our day based off of your values, based off of your principles in life, best way of approaching life in that way to which nobody else can hear them. And it's just something specifically for you, packaged for you.
Like your very own imaginary friend.
Yeah.
And that sounds really cool.
Maybe you could use mixed reality.
More like a personal assistant.
Yeah. And then you could use mixed reality to maybe, in your own viewpoint, your little imaginary friend is actually there in some bodily form or what have you.
Well, that's definitely putting a positive light on something that people could perceive as negative, just like you were talking before about the perceived Wall-E scenario not really being the case potentially. And people do have this idea of, oh man, this is going to be so horrible. And then it turns out to be something that people can't live without anymore. And I wouldn't say always in a positive way, like I told you before about the kids who are constantly glued to their iPads. But I really like the term that she used, not a utopia, not a dystopia, but what was it? Nootropia.
Yeah.
I like that idea because things are going to be given and things are going to be taken from this exchange. But it's definitely going to open the interesting. I think
that the only thing that will exist is going to be nootropia because as much as we love the idea of perfection, a perfect world, that will never transpire because that there will always be a challenge. There will always be a question needing to be answered. There will always need to be an issue needing to be addressed. And so there will always be this nootropia. The concepts of utopia and dystopia, I feel, are things that dystopia is not something that will find ourselves in, but it is a vision that helps keep us vigilant. It's something that helps keep us thinking of scenarios that we should try to avoid and have a conversation and figure out ways to not end up in that world. And utopias are these things that embolden us. They're the ones that make us dream and think of a better future. What is utopia for each individual? You know, for somebody that's dealing with a bank not taking away their home because they couldn't pay their mortgage because they're in a fucking low income community. Their concept of utopia would probably be, I want a home that's not going to be taken away from me. It's going to be mine. It's something that I call my own. Or some utopia for a little black kid in Chicago is probably, utopia would be where the black community and the cops are not at war with one another, where their own community are not at war with one another. There is no such thing as the Ku Klux Klan or neo-Nazis. Maybe that's their concept of utopia, but it's what keeps them dreaming of a better future, keeps them thinking that the world of tomorrow will be better and we just have to keep moving forward. And so even though we'll always be in this sort of nootropian scenario where there's good things and bad things still occurring, so long our pursuit for utopia remains, there'll always be a good day on the horizon as opposed to a dystopian outlook.
What's the difference between a nootropia and an extropia? Because earlier I also heard you refer to extropia for
the extropians were that libertarian group of people that Max Moore and company formed. That was more of a libertarian aspect of transhumanism. It had nothing to do with something being utopian or dystopian or what have you. It was more of an ideological pursuit of transhumanism.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I remember it as an alternative to utopia, but the way you described nootropia, it sounded the same to me. So
there are similar concepts. The idea that utopia would never be fully achieved and that there'll always be an issue on the horizon, because that's where a lot of like the morphological freedom concept came from, Max Moore, and the proactionary principle that was also coined by Max Moore to sort of counterbalance against the precautionary principle. This idea, if there's a risk, we should avoid it. We should just stop from right there and not continue pursuing a certain technology because of the risks. And the idea with proactionary principle was, well, yeah, there's going to be risks, but we also should continue moving forward and have a conversation about what those risks are. How can we best approach them so that in the event that these technologies come into fruition, perhaps those risks won't arise, or perhaps they won't arise at as detrimentally as we had initially thought, because we actually took the time to consider how to best address them when they did. And it's just the idea that utopia may never be here. We may never achieve utopia, but there are always great things that can come out of a terrible situation within that time frame, and that we should be more active in figuring out, we should be more communal and figuring out how to address these issues, because regardless of what you how you believe or how you view the world as an individual, there are certain risks that are going to affect us as a whole, and so we should come together and figure out how to address them in the event if or when they actually occur.
So speaking on the pro-actionary principle, and moving away from the tech side and more to the biotech side, and this can be the last topic we really dive into. These scientists are advocating more experiments with creating human and other animal hybrids or chimeras. I know there was an article about a human and sheep hybrid. And now there is an article in Nautilus about creating a human chimp.
The human chimp chimera was the initial one that started the whole controversy. And the more recent one, which was just, it happened just before New Year's, was the sheep and human chimera. And yeah, I get the controversy surrounding it, where the very idea that we are splicing human DNA, even though in the sheep-human chimera, it was over 99% sheep, and there was like a fraction of human DNA added into it, and it was only there for about 28 days, I believe. The whole concept was to try and see if human DNA could be successfully spliced into this embryo in the hopes that maybe someday we could provide organs, readily available organs for people that are on donation lists, and help decrease that list and decrease the wait time and actually save lives.
And it also seems like these would be prerequisite studies for like cross-disciplinary splicing, if you wanted to, you know, develop regenerative genetics, like some, like lizards have or something, where like if you chop off a finger and the finger grows back, the only way you could develop that kind of genetic technology is you first have to understand the basic building blocks.
If you were to expose our building blocks with that of the building blocks of a chameleon or some type of lizard, what would that, how would it, would it react? Because we can't just simply add it onto a human and say, let's just see what happens. If you start creating limbs, cool. If you start turning into this weird creature, oh well. I hope that's not what happens. And that I think that these chimeras, where the human DNA is initially introduced and they keep it in there for about less than a month and then completely destroy the DNA sequence, to I feel like that is the approach that we need to take if that is the route that we're going to take in terms of figuring out ways of helping save people using other animals as a source. Mostly because they're embryos at the end of the day. And so long we're not messing with actual breathing sentient life at the current moment, I feel like it shouldn't be as controversial as it is at the moment.
Well, we don't know that, though. We don't know what kind of black ops type things are happening. Who knows what's going on in China right now? Nobody's really paying that close of an attention to things that they can't have any idea of, right?
Well, sure. There could be something completely nefarious taking place. But until we actually have evidence that these things are occurring or that something truly bad is occurring, we should give the benefit of the doubt to the scientific community, because as much as bad things have happened, the scientific community has been quite proactive in terms of dealing with people that go far beyond than what the community allows for. You know, with the give an example being the whole hoopla about supposedly vaccines cause autism. That was an initial study that was from the 90s, and the scientific community today have largely disagreed against that narrative and took action to make sure that that person would not do research anymore, that he would no longer be allowed to provide these narratives that are based off of faulty data, that were based off of his own ideological bias against vaccinations. And I feel like so long the community remains open-minded, but not open-minded to the extent that their minds fall out, to use that cliche, but I feel that the scientific community are in a good place now to where we should at least give them the benefit of the doubt, because they're able to self-regulate pretty well at the moment. And if anything bad happens, we should definitely be vigilant. But until we find any evidence for it, I don't think that we should worry too much about it. It just creates too much.
I agree with that
we would put on ourselves. And it's this borderline area of becoming paranoid just for the sake of paranoia.
Mm-hmm. Lev, what would be, so imagine for the sake of conversation, China was doing a lot more genetic experiments than we know about. Wouldn't that be good in the long run if they were to share what they learned? Like, hoping that they don't just hold a monopoly on the scientific advancements and they made their discoveries open source, what would be the problem? Like, let's say they made a human squid hybrid and they let the thing grow up and they have like all sorts of human and other animal chimeras and they're letting these things grow up and then they're testing antibiotics on them, they're crossbreeding them, they're just doing all sorts of wild stuff. So that would be a worst case scenario for you, right, Lev?
There would be another worst case scenario for me, honestly. That part of it I just find fascinating because it's like we're creating our own Pokemon, you could say. But the part that I find a little bit more troublesome is if we get to the point that certain parts of the human body that are going to be infused into the human being upon being born or even before being born would be patented. Companies would have patents on it. And recently there was that story in Saudi Arabia of there being the first AI citizen or first robot citizen. I don't remember exactly what it was.
It was Sophia, that was created by Bing Wurtzel, AI researcher. And that was more symbolic than anything. And it was just that was their way of trying to initialize the conversation of the idea of an AI or robot citizen, because that's something that's going to become much more prevalent as time goes by. And so Sophia was sort of used as a symbolic gesture of let's start the conversation here. And Saudi Arabia with their I forget what they're calling it, but it was that future type city that they're wanting to create, and a new visioning for Saudi Arabia. I guess that was their way of saying, look, that is what we're doing. We just gave a robot, a female robot, no less, citizenship.
And no hijab either, right?
No hijab or anything like that.
Well, that's interesting to me. Like, I don't have a problem with that happening, but my only concern is psychologically how people in the future will react to people who are, let's say, half robot, half person, or if people have these patented genes or whatever parts of their body happen to be owned by some company. Then my fear is that instead of the robot people being elevated to people, people will be diselevated, will be lowered down to robots, where the way that we're approaching people today, like as far as the sweatshops in Asia go and various other horrible conditions that a lot of people in the third world are living in, that there would be this technocratic group of people who would take a look at everybody else who isn't part of the Elysium Club as these beings that they have copyright on, that they have patents on, that they could do whatever they want with, who don't actually have a humanity, because there's no such thing as a humanity. Like, that's like, I'm afraid of that kind of thing happening for human beings, for their own humanity to be disvalued, along with the disvaluing of human robot hybrids as well. Like, I'm not going to elevate one over the other in this conversation. It's more of, I don't want everything to be lowered down.
I feel like that. So would you say that if those patents, if the DNA was not being patented and controlled by any single person, would you be more open to those ideas and more expressions and actions of figuring out how far we can take the human body or the human biological makeup? Would you be more open to it if the patents did not exist? If that was, if the idea of patenting DNA was, say, criminalized and something that no single person should be able to do, that it should be more open to the community as a whole?
While I have to keep in mind unintended consequences, I would definitely be a lot more open to a bottom-up approach, like I said before, as opposed to a top-down approach. I'm always concerned.
I'm not in favor of patenting DNA. I feel like that would be a move that would have vast consequences that I don't think that we would benefit from it too well, because something like DNA is something that should be more open for people to, and that I love the open source community that's coming out of the biohacking movement, where they are sharing information and going out of their way to not try to make a profit off of it, that it's in the pursuit of research, in the pursuit of knowledge, and in the pursuit of bettering ourselves as people, as humans. And I think that should be our approach to when it comes to DNA, and not put in patents, because that fear could transpire into something greater. You know, it's as like your poster behind you for the Minds, Gathering of the Minds. I love the poster. I love the Minds website. I love their social media application there. But it, you know, it's that concept, that very idea that we can come together and it should be open for everyone, as opposed to under patents and under these companies' control. It should be more open to the community.
I love that, and I'm totally with you there. That's why I don't want there to be people who are in charge and telling other people what to do. Right. Like, since I came from Russia, you could say I was born in the Soviet Union. It was around 1988 that I was born, so the Soviet Union was still active. Although not as active as they thought they'd be.
I was born when the Soviet Union was still around, but I was in 91, in February of 91. So I got like 11 months of the Soviet Union left. But
in that scenario that my parents lived in, they had friends of theirs who got into mental institutions because they thought communism wasn't a good idea. their brains were totally scrambled by the drugs that they were administered, and it wasn't drugs to help them. It was intentionally drugs to screw their brains up as a warning to any other dissidents. So that is, to me, the worst case scenario when it comes to people, like a small group of people, having a lot of power over a lot of people. And the more decentralized things could be, both when it comes to the question of what happens with our DNA, what happens with any other decision that would, like, I know scientists are talking about right now, dimming the sun, putting something in the atmosphere to fight global warming. And I was like, are you guys sure this is the right move? Like, all these sweeping ideas that people have, that's the thing that I want to keep my eye on. And I encourage everybody to keep their eye on, because those are the things that are going to affect the most people without there being an anti-fragile type effect from a lot of smaller organizations working on something. One tries something, it fails. Another tries something, it succeeds. Another's copy it. That I see as much more of an organic approach and a much more safer approach to this whole brave new world that we're going into right now.
Right. You know, I would definitely agree. We should be more open. And, you know, it goes right back to one of the initial questions of, like, my interest of blockchain and AI, is that they will help us create those systems if we're vigilant about it, if we're able to focus more on how can we best bring more people into the conversation, have more people involved in the process of creating these technologies, because the greater the perspective that is available, the greater the resources and their awareness of the world, the greater that we will be at treating that world and each other better. And that with greater knowledge comes greater responsibility and greater perspectives. And hopefully, as an artificial super intelligence comes, maybe, hopefully, for the sake of it, and for the sake of us, we'll also create this artificial super empathy with it as well. And it'll have a greater perspective than even us in terms of how we should treat each other better and whatever comes after us.
Hmm.
That was well said. That was beautiful. Well, BJ, thank you so much for being a part of Sowing Discourse. It was an honor to have you.
I'm glad I was here.
BJ, thank you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And guys, please like, comment, and subscribe. And don't forget to click the bell to receive more updates. Take care, everybody.